Where's Amy this morning?
Some river.
Open this hearing of the House Rules Committee. Welcome, everybody. I don't know why everybody's sitting in the back row. I think I scared them, Mr. Chairman.
We're talking about the church.
It is Friday, June 24th. We have two bills on our agenda, and we're going to introduce one other measure. Our plan is to move Senate Bill 395 today, and even though it's a work session to give folks a chance on the amendments to Senate Bill 412, we are waiting on one other amendment to Senate Bill 412 that is completely unrelated to Senate Bill 412, but it's related to conflict amendments for another bill that we're going to have to wait and move that on Monday morning. But the full content, I think, of the amendments on 412 will be known today. But let's start off with a possible introduction of committee measures.
Mr. Chairman, this is LC 4260. It has to do with adjourning the session.
This is the infamous sign-and-die resolution.
Mr. Chair.
Co-Charles.
I would actually make the move that the Vice Chair immediately to your left make this move.
Signaling neither approval nor dissent.
Representative Berger.
I move, Mr. Chair, I move LC 4260, dated 6/23/11, be accepted as a committee bill for the Rules Committee.
Representative Berger moves the introduction of LC 4260, dated June 23rd, 2011, as a committee measure. Any discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, introduction of a committee measure does not imply either support or opposition to anything submitted here or any other implications. Thank you for letting me put that on the record.
However, in this case,
there is
unanimous.
There is support. I know there's support within the body for this particular measure.
Seeing no other discussion, any objection? So ordered. So let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 395B.
Mr. Chairman, this is Senate Bill 395B. It clarifies driving under the influence, this is a DUI, under ORS 813.0105 as a Category 6 felony with 12 to 14-month presumptive sentence that allows the state to reimburse counties for the cost of incarcerating those charged with and convicted of this third DUI. It directs counties to use the existing reimbursement rate, which is used to reimburse counties for cost of inmates serving 12 months or less. It directs the Department of Corrections to make rules for counties to seek this reimbursement, and it requires reimbursements be made from monies appropriated to the Department of Corrections for that purpose. It declares an emergency effective upon passage.
And do you have the fiscal impact statement on this? Because I forgot to pull that up. No, there is some savings to the general fund.
We'll have that for you in a moment.
Okay.
Actually, $3 million
or something.
I think if you brought up the director of the Criminal Justice Commission,
that would be great. You want to come forward, and I'm sure you've got that fiscal impact statement committed to.
Craig might have that all figured out. Yeah.
Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Craig Prinz. I'm the executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission. Co-Chair Olson, I do not have that fiscal committed to memory. The big picture is this will reduce the fiscal impact of the measure that was passed by the voters, and it will set up the way that DOC can pay for the 90-day minimum, at least 90-day minimum jail that the offenders would serve on their third DUI in 10 years. So, but I apologize, I don't have the fiscal with me either.
Of course, the possibility of Elizabeth Kushwar might know that too. She does not either.
We're having it printed out.
Oh, good.
Be here in just a few minutes.
Okay. Any questions for Craig in terms of the content of this change? It's obviously coming over, having been worked on the Senate side.
Mr. Chair, it has been a long time since I've actually paid attention to the categories, and it would be useful for me to have a very short explanation of Category 6 and how it fits into the scheme of things.
Thank you for asking for that.
Maybe.
Well, I used to work with this stuff all the time, and in fact, we passed the criminal code in 1971 when I started my law practice, so I was very familiar with it then, but it's changed a bunch in the meantime.
And maybe if you can connect that to what the law was pre-Measure 73, the 73...
I'd be happy to do that, co-chairs and Representative Barnhart. So the upshot is Measure 73 made, before Measure 73, your third DUII within 10 years was a misdemeanor. And so the judge could really give as much jail as they chose. There's really not a lot of guidance on misdemeanors in the Oregon system. Measure 73 said your third DUI has to be a C felony. So it first made it a felony. And it also said there must be a minimum of 90 days jail for your third or subsequent DUII. So it said a minimum of 90 days jail. The way it was written, when it said it's a Class C felony, that activated a current statute, ORS 813.012, which was passed in 99, which said any felony DUII is a crime category 6 on the criminal justice sentencing guidelines. What the effect of that would be, Representative Barnhart, is rather than having, thank you, Patsy, you would have, I think the Mr. Stenberg said, what that would do is would set a presumptive prison sentence as a 6 of 13 to 30 months. What this does is it clarifies the level 6 is for your fourth DUI. This will allow the Criminal Justice Commission to differentiate between your third DUI in 10 years and your fourth DUI in 10 years, and I believe get it closer to what the citizens intended, which was you have to have a minimum of 90 days jail. I think that was the real import of the citizen measure. So this clarifies, Rep. Barnhart, that the level 6 is for your fourth DUII and allows the Criminal Justice Commission to set your third on the guidelines. And the part that does all that is the part that says, in the first section of the measure, I don't have in front of me, it says 813.010 subsection 5, that little subsection 5, makes sure that level 6 is for your fourth DUI. So that's what it does. And that's what would then reduce the fiscal impact of this measure.
So, Craig, could you relate that? We all just got handed out the fiscal, and I think you have a copy of it.
I do have.
This fiscal looks like this measure actually cost significantly more money, but I thought this measure was saving money over Measure 73. So, can you walk us through this?
Yeah, so co-chairs co-chair Hunt, to walk you through that. So, this measure will save money over the initiative as passed. What you're seeing here is the cost that it will have to have those jail sanctions. So the next section of this is not only is there a 90-day minimum jail sentence, but the state will reimburse the counties for that minimum and the pretrial incarceration. So the cost you're seeing is not a prison cost. It's the cost of those reimbursements, which will actually reduce the overall cost because they'll be serving a local jail sentence, not going to prison. So I hope that helps.
And so do you happen to remember, the figure I have in my mind is it's something like a $3 million savings over what would have been without this bill. Does that sound right to you?
Coach, I think it's at least that. I think it's at least that, and I don't have the figure of the savings, but it's at least that much of a savings.
Okay. That would probably be helpful for us to have on the, at least by the time we get to the floor.
Absolutely.
I think this fiscal is going to confuse a lot of members just the way it's written. It looks like this change costs more money.
Yeah, it does. I agree.
Further questions for Craig?
Okay.
Thank you.
Cheyenne, anything else?
I have one more.
Okay,
if
for Craig.
I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. I just recalled there are counties where jail space is limited.
Yes, sir.
What effect would this bill have on things like the matrix system in Lane County or other similar situations?
Co-chairs, Representative Barnhart, it's a great question. These offenders have to be held for 90 days. They cannot be matrixed. So they this Lane County, for example, I think this will also give the budget to operate additional beds. But in law, these would not be ones that the sheriff could matrix out. They need to do that at least a 90-day minimum. So I think it will change those counties that were matrixing out offenders. We looked at this, Representative Barnhart. Most of these offenders already were doing more than, or were doing around 90 days. The average was a little bit more. In some counties, they were doing less. So I think, I hope that answers your question.
If I understand this fiscal statement correctly, we're talking about 170 people at any one time. I'm looking at the penultimate paragraph.
Co-chairs, Representative Barnhart, my analyst tried to put it into beds, so it would be number of jail beds.
Right.
So it'd be a lot. It'd be more offenders than that, but the statewide number of jail beds would be required to be 170.
So something like 17, 18 in Lane County.
Oh,
for 10% of the population. I'm just making that up.
Higher percentage of the offenders, though.
Yeah,
that's true.
Co-chairs, Representative Barnhart, if you'd like, I can have my. My staff looked at it by county and also inquired as to the Lane County judges and DAs how they'd implement this.
So I can, on this topic, where are the sheriffs on this bill? Or are we going to hear from them?
They were in the room.
The
back of the room.
I know nothing about this topic. It might be really helpful to find out what they think about it.
Their representative literally just gave a thumbs up from the back of the room.
If
you'd like to question them, we can bring
that
them
forward. That answers my question. Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything else for Craig?
Thank you.
And we are, I believe, thanks. Appreciate you coming forward. I think LFO staff is going to be arriving through the door momentarily just to give final clarification to the fiscal. Unless Cheyenne went to grab them. We'll see.
You want to stand at these?
Yeah, let's just stand at these for a moment.
So it's going to be Doug.
Committee will come back to order. Thanks for coming, Doug. I don't know if you heard any of the conversation.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I was down on council, so I heard indirectly in the hall that you were looking for someone. So
I think if you can make sure he has a copy of the fiscal in front of him, Patsy, you're crazy. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think the basic question is the testimony has been, and the understanding seems clear, that Senate Bill 395 will save several million dollars over the current situation post Measure 73. This is one of those fiscals that looks like it actually costs net money. So if you can introduce yourself and walk us through that.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Doug Wilson with the Legislative Fiscal Office. The number you have on the fiscal, the $12.6 million, is what is in the budget, in the working budget for the Department of Corrections at this time. It assumes passage of 395. If 395 does not pass, the additional cost over and above this 12.6 would be roughly $5.5 million.
Okay.
I don't have the number right on the top of my head. So
right.
So you're going from generally, and I'd let Mr. Prinz be the more specific on the legal side of this, going from sort of a presumptive prison term,
right.
To 395 then goes to a presumptive jail term for that. And the jail term costs is the 12.6. If we go back to the prison side, you'd have to add another roughly $5.5 million.
Would it be possible maybe to add a line just noting that $5.5 million figure before this gets to the members on the floor?
That.
I think that'll be helpful explanation. That's great. Question for Doug, Representative Holby.
Well, Mr. Chair, if that's the case, wouldn't there be a revenue impact of $5.5 million to this bill?
No, it's not. As I understand it, it's fiscal savings that we'll
right
money we won't have to expend. There's no should be no revenue impact.
Is and right? We're talking yeah. general fund on this also.
Yeah. $5.5 million state general fund savings by passing this.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
You're
right. We'll go back to legislative council. Thanks, Doug. We are in a work session. Coach Olson.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 395B to the House floor with to the House floor with due pass recommendation.
Do we have
a quorum.
Yes, just barely. Co-Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 395B to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Patsy, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Excuse.
Representative Garrett?
Excuse.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Wingard?
Yes.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye. Measure carries, and I would be... Oh. Someone else? Well, I'm happy to carry this. Or do you want to carry this? Oh, sure. I'll carry it. Co-Chair Olson will carry it.
Paper, okay. Scissors?
Close the work session on Senate Bill 395B. And let's open a work session on Senate Bill 412B. For those of you who weren't here earlier, I want you to describe what it is. And then,
Mr. Chairman, we have Cheyenne Ross, who I thought was going to do the administration. Is she going to do the explanation of this? Is that what you prefer to do? Okay, do you want me to do...
Co-chairs, members, and Mr. Simbridge, yeah, that's fine. I know the B version of the bill, but I haven't seen the amendments. I'm happy to describe the B version of the bill.
So why don't you go ahead and do the explanation, and then maybe you can join us at the dais and
sure.
be the staff
Thank
person
you.
For this.
And let me again, just describe the plan is to describe, again, what the bill is, what the proposed amendments are, to give folks a chance to come and testify on it. As I said earlier, if you weren't here, we are awaiting an additional set of conflict amendments that have nothing to do with this bill. They have to do with Senate Bill 405, the university police bill. So a set of conflict amendments that have to catch up somewhere, and this seems to be the only vehicle they're going to catch up in. So our plan right now is to reschedule it for 8 a.m. on Monday, but we want to deal with all the content of 412 today and make sure we're fully informed and ready to go when that time comes. So Cheyenne, please.
Mr. Chair, co-chair, and members, Cheyenne Ross, I am one of the small army of staff for the Judiciary Committee. Senate Bill 412B, we prepared the SMS for you all, the draft, relatively late, but I think it's been handed out in a hard copy of the dais. This measure provides authorized tribal police officers with certain powers and protections that are provided to Oregon law enforcement if certain conditions are met. Those conditions include certification of individuals by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and the commitment of tribal governments to comply with certain insurance requirements, adopt policies regarding discovery in criminal cases in conformity with state law and neighboring jurisdictions, and codification of a waiver of sovereign immunity from tort liability in tribal law. It, in the the B version creates a transition into this grant of authority, limiting the scope of the authority for the first 2 years to three specific situations outside of Indian country and unrestricted scope within Indian country. The three specific situations outside Indian country would be hot pursuit, commission of a crime in the officer's presence, and upon the request or approval of a law enforcement agency with jurisdiction over the crime. Those provisions would sunset July 1st, 2013, and the full scope of authority, making the officers all equivalent with each other, would ensue for the following 6 years and sunset July of 2019, and we revert to the law as it exists today under the Kurtz case. There's a definition of Indian country, and funding, public funds, state public funds, would be prohibited from flowing to tribal governments for law enforcement activities under the measure. That is the B version of the bill.
And so in terms of the proposed amendment, which I think is going to be the dash one, isn't it?
I believe that's right.
Okay. Do you want to, who's in the best place to walk through?
Actually, I think, Mr. Chair,
let's see, who would be, Pete, you probably would have a good handle on this since, you know, I've been working on this thing.
To clarify, Pete is not bringing forward these recommendations, but or these, this amendment, but if you want to walk through your perspective on them, that'd be great, Pete.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd, and I am representing the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw tribes. Indeed, the tribes are not the advocates of these amendments, but I'm happy to help the committee by describing what I understand them to be. And I am basing my description primarily on a written document that I received describing in bullet point form the dash B11 amendments, or indicated to be the dash B11 amendments.
And colleagues, the basic text of that, I think, is captured in this on the bottom of the SMS, the effect of the committee amendment. It's not labeled with a specific number, but the content is. Do you have a copy of the SMS?
I do not, Mr. Coach.
Could you give him a copy of the SMS just so he can? And there's two different pieces of paper, but they both have the same content.
Mr. Chairman, if I can clarify for the process part of this, as soon as committee staff gets the amendment, we will post it on the committee's webpage, which is available to the public. It's on the legislative webpage. If you go to committees, it'll be under House Rules.
Very well. Ms. Ross has described the phase-in and subsequent sunset provision. One amendment in one feature of the dash B11s is to shorten that second full authority period from the current 6 years to 2 years. So the total scope of the bill until sunset would then be 4 years in effect. There are additional requirements imposed on the tribal governments that they would have to satisfy in order to meet the requirements necessary to achieve full authorization for their officers to become what the bill defines as authorized tribal police officers. So the tribal government in the dash B11 amendments would be required to adopt a specific provision of tribal law relating to access to public access to records that pertain to the exercise of the authority granted to authorized tribal police officers by the bill. That requirement, the requirement of the bill is that the tribal law be substantially similar to the manner in which those records would, similar records would be available and subject to the same exemptions, kinds of exemptions that would be available if their requests were made instead under the state public records law. There is a requirement additionally that the tribal government provide for the preservation of biological evidence, again in a manner substantially similar to that this body has required other law enforcement agencies to perform in this session in enrolled Senate Bill 731. The tribal government would be explicitly required to participate in and be bound by deadly physical force planning. You recall this sometimes referred to as the Senate Bill 111 process. That process, by way of brief reminder, is it establishes in each county a deadly force planning authority that's chaired by the sheriff and the district attorney. The planning authority has specified membership, and then those authorities develop plans, and those plans then have binding effect in some circumstances on law enforcement agencies that are subject to those plans. It's important to note about this amendment that it says to the same extent that a county sheriff is required to participate in and be bound by the plan. And perhaps by way of reminder about Senate Bill 111, it contains, that set of statute contains a anti-unfunded mandate provision, for want of a better term, which this body specified in Senate Bill 111 that most of the burdens of that statute would not be binding on local law enforcement or on the planning authority if there were insufficient funds allocated to the Department of Justice for the purpose of funding the grant program that was provided in that Senate Bill 111 process. So you need to know, I think, in your decision making about this element of the bill, that there hasn't been that funding. So as a matter of compulsion of law right now, Senate Bill 111 really has very little effect, except for very complicated reasons, on police agencies that employ more than 40 sworn police officers, which I don't think any tribal government does. So this places the tribal government in the same relationship to the burdens of that law as local governments are currently, but you need to know that currently, in my view, local governments aren't subject to any burdens under that because of the unfunded mandate provision. The Dash B11 amendments would add a process that sheriffs have the option but are not compelled to exercise of approaching tribal government and saying to the tribal government, we want our deputy sheriffs to be authorized to exercise on tribal lands powers as to tribal members under tribal law that are the equivalent of the powers that are granted by the bill to tribal officers as to non-tribal members outside of tribal lands. And the sheriff is authorized to approach the tribal council within a 90-day window, as I understand the amendments. And then the tribal council is required to consider that in good faith and to negotiate with the sheriff in good faith about the terms of that authorization and to make a decision as to whether it would grant that authority or not. And the consequence of not granting that authority is that both the sheriff and the tribal government would be obligated to compile information for the use of this body as to the potentially detrimental effect, if any, of the absence of the requested authority, so that you can make a considered decision later about whether that's a feature of the law that needs to be changed or not, as the case may be. In terms of the, since I have the opportunity, I'll simply indicate that the Confederate, my client, is indifferent as to these amendments. I do not see these as doing any injury to my client's interest, nor do I, frankly, perceive these as invading tribal sovereignty in any way. It leaves the tribes in complete control of the decisions about their sovereignty. My client will continue to support the bill, urge its passage, even if all of these amendments are included as I've described them, and we would further urge the Senate to concur in those amendments, and that's my client's position.
Questions for Pete?
Somebody else could probably also answer this question, but it's when we heard this bill before, I pondered this, and not being conversant in 18 U.S.C. 1151, what is Indian country defined as?
Indian country, I would defer to Mr. Mason, I think, as the superior expert on that because he practices more often in the Indian law area. Let me give you the layperson's
that was sufficient
explanation,
okay,
and that is it includes all reservations, it includes the trust lands. In effect, it includes all of the lands that we've been referring in the discussions of the bill to as sort of tribal lands. That's my layperson.
But it does not include land that is operated as a fee, lands that they've purchased and they are running operations on, but that those would remain under county jurisdiction?
Now we're in a territory where I don't want to mislead you in any way. I think the answer to your question is no, but Mr. Mason would be the superior expert on that question.
Why don't you come forward?
Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt. Co-Chair Olson, for the record, my name is Michael Mason. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs, the Confederated Tribes of the Siletz Indians. And to the question, Representative Berger, it's clear under federal law that any fee land that a tribe owns, it's not in trust, there's no United States interest, that there's full jurisdiction by state and local law enforcement over Indians and non-Indians on that land. Full criminal jurisdiction.
That's what I wanted to get on the record. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Michael, do you have other thoughts in terms of these proposed amendments?
Well, I think in terms of my understanding is in terms of particularly the amendment about tribal member assistance with law enforcement, where tribal members are alleged to violate tribal code, tribal criminal laws. My understanding is that's already the case on the Siletz Reservation. Now, as to Warm Springs, and I would say that I think all of my clients welcome the opportunity to work with their local law enforcement, with the sheriffs, especially to improve law enforcement on the reservation. And we would urge speedy action on the bill.
Okay. So. Freeman.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm late. Full Ways and Means is over.
For now.
Not for today. I think I got here just in time to ask the question I've been wanting to ask since we started talking about this bill. In my district, there is a tribe that I've had wonderful experience working with, and I recognize that our sheriff's department does all their law enforcement work for them. Right. I was expecting when I talked to my sheriff to hear a great report on how well that all works. That is not what I heard. I heard that our tribe is very obstinate in letting our sheriff's do any sort of investigation within their properties, something as simple as if there is a fugitive suspected to be in their casino, they won't tell them the room. And I was very surprised by that. And from what I understand, the federal law doesn't allow them to be that way. Have I got that correct? I mean,
Co-chairs.
This is Douglas County area.
Yes, Representative. Co-chairs Hunt and Olson and Representative Freeman. And I'm saying this not that I am speaking for that tribe, and I don't have to speak for that tribe because I helped write some of the restoration acts that affect other neighboring tribes. And all of the federal laws that restored tribes in Western Oregon are very clear. The state shall have full criminal jurisdiction on the reservations and lands of these tribes. That's a direct quote. Something I've been carrying around, and of course today's the day I don't bring the U.S. Code with me. They're carrying around all week, but it is very clear that the OSP, the sheriff, whomever, you know, has the same criminal jurisdiction on tribal members, other Indians, non-Indians, on these reservations as they would if they were off-reservation.
Thank you. And that's the way when I read it, I understood it too. It just isn't in practice that way, and that's an educational process, so thank you.
Any other questions for either of these two gentlemen? Appreciate you both coming forward. Is there anyone else who would like to weigh in? Come on forward, Paul. Anyone else would like to weigh in on the proposed amendments? Obviously, we've already had a full hearing on the base bill, but I'd love your thoughts on the proposed called E11 amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. And, Mr. Chair and members, I did have a brief conversation with Mr. Shepherd out in the hallway after we began to look at the description of the amendments. And they appear to address a number of the concerns that we have. One issue that I think that can be addressed simply by putting it on the record has to do with the issue of what does the language in Senate Bill 412 mean when it says that a tribe would agree to waive its sovereign immunity in a manner similar to the Tort Claims Act. I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty much what it says. And one issue that we had was, does that include defense and indemnification of the officers who are acting within the course and scope of their responsibilities? And I think we agreed that it would, and that it should probably be stated in the record that that would be the case. And I would invite Mr. Shepherd to comment or disagree if I've misstated what we talked about.
Okay. Thanks, Paul. John, or we'll get back in a moment.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Brian DeLeischmidt. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Oregon State Police Officers Association. Having just seen the description of the proposed amendments at 10 o'clock and not being aware that they were in process, I'm trying to digest. I want to clarify up front that when I testified before, I had stated very clearly that the OCPA and the OSPOA thought that there were a lot of very good provisions in the bill as it came to you, including protection as far as assault and so forth of these officers. The one concern I did have is the reciprocity or the enforcement of state law on tribal lands, the non-PL 280 as I understand it. And Representative Freeman's question is related to the tribes on the east, on the west side. That same law does not apply, obviously, on the east side in at least a couple of circumstances. In reading the description, I had at least one question about it. If you go down to the 90-day process in which the state and local law enforcement may apply to the tribal government, if you continue on with that next sentence, while the amendments provide some criteria for state and local law enforcement agencies must meet, is also envisioned that negotiations between others are concerning other requirements. In the negotiations, what you're talking about up above is the enforcement of tribal law on tribal lands, and that really wasn't the issue that I had that I was bringing forward. I was bringing forward the enforcement of state law on tribal lands. And the example that I was giving is if you have a tribal member who's done a crime off of tribal lands, and the state or local law enforcement then has a warrant to go onto tribal lands or is attempting to go and serve that warrant on tribal lands, that's enforcement of state law on tribal lands. So I did have a discussion with Mr. Shepherd, and when he comes up, maybe we can have additional discussion about this, about whether or not the enforcement of tribal laws on tribal lands includes the enforcement of state law on tribal lands by a state or local law enforcement official. And at least my read in the discussion we had was that it would then require the tribal government to adopt state law in order for it to become tribal law, in order for a state officer or a county officer to enforce that law on tribal lands. So I think that's the one clarification that we would need to feel comfortable with this. Hopefully I haven't confused too much, but that's my issue, is sure. state law being enforced on tribal lands.
Okay. Thanks, Brian. John?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is John C. Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And our concern is still with the reciprocity language. And for the sheriffs, this is an issue based just basically on equality, that a law enforcement agency in Oregon, whether tribal or non-tribal, should all have the same rules, know where jurisdictional boundaries are, and how they can operate within those boundaries. Our suggestion would be to put the language urging a negotiation of an MOU as a precondition to a tribal agency being certified as a policing agency, so that local county law enforcement and tribal agencies can meet, negotiate out a deal on law enforcement in Indian country and outside Indian country prior to a tribal agency being granted the ability to enforce Oregon state law outside Indian country. And that. Any questions the committee may have?
John, would you say that obviously this approach and this amendment is not what you're describing? It's more of a Solomonic approach of let's try it for a couple of years and see if the sky falls. And if it does, I mean, obviously it requires legislative action to either lengthen the sunset or broaden the authority. From your perspective, although this may not be what you would ideally write, is this approach in this amendment better than the base bill as it was written from your perspective, from your guys' perspective?
Co-Chair Hunt, yes. Many of these things are things that the evidence retention are things the sheriffs have really asked for, and the final sticking point is this kind of reciprocity issue. And it would be, you know, if they were writing the bill, they would write the bill to where tribal police can operate off tribal land and state of Oregon police agencies can operate on tribal land, and there's an agreement between the two and everybody knows what those rules are. That said, the invitation to have a negotiation within 90 days is better than nothing, but we would still like to see it as a precondition to being a licensed police agency as opposed to a condition that occurs after being licensed.
Any other questions for these three folks, Representative Laird?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, I want to go back to your first point about being concerned that the language is that they must negotiate something similar to the statute, and you brought up the issue of, if I heard you right, it was about indemnifying officers, making sure they would be included in that. Why wouldn't we, I assume there's some reason for stating similar rather than precisely the same, but why can't we say similar to but must include indemnity of the officers? Because that seems to, I mean, that's a critical issue. I would be concerned falling through in anything that's going to be similar. I mean, obviously making sure that officers are protected when they're working in the scope of their, you know, of being an officer is critical.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, well, that would certainly be clearer. But in our discussions, it appeared as though at this point the likelihood of additional amendments had narrowed. And I expect that putting it in the record that's what the language means would probably get us to where we need it to go.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Weird?
Yeah, I remain concerned. Since this isn't going to be taken up until Monday morning, there is a chance to get that additional piece in if all the sides can agree to it. I just think that making it, I mean, I haven't been around as long as others, but I have a sense that just putting things on the record doesn't always result in that follow-through out there in the implementation of these laws. So it would make me more comfortable if there was a reference to that one piece being, you know, in any agreement. Because if that did not happen, I think you could be opening up individual officers to a nightmare scenario of litigation. So,
okay, that was more of a comment than a question, right?
Well, it was an invitation, no. I hope.
But not for these three gentlemen so much.
Well, there is time. I mean, there's time. We're not going to actually vote amendments into this bill until Monday, so.
Representative Berger, did you have...
Well, I was going to say, I think I would invite Mr. Snyder to come up with draft language that covers this. We'll see if we can get it amended in.
And Mr. Chair, before, honestly, we've had this conversation along this whole issue right now. I think Mr. Shepard could probably address this a little bit better because we've had that conversation. It would give you some enlightenment why we've not gone there.
Okay. That would help.
Thank you all. Appreciate you coming up. And, Pete, people have been kind enough to give you a couple of questions already in your absence to respond to. And actually, anyone else who would like to weigh in on this, we'd invite to come forward. Anyone representing the other tribes? No pressure. Go ahead, Pete.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, again, for the record, Pete Shepard. First, with respect to Delashmiut's observations, as is described in the materials you have before you, he correctly described that the negotiation would pertain to the prospect of the deputy sheriff or other police officer exercising authority on tribal lands as to tribal members with respect to tribal law. And I do think that as I look at the face of the language here, that in order for that to extend to the deputy sheriff enforcing state law on those in that those territories, that it would indeed be necessary, I think, for the tribal government to adopt state law as an element, or elements at least of it, as an element of the tribal code, much as cities now frequently adopt state criminal law as part of their state, as part of their city ordinances that are enforced by the local city police. I think that's a fair reading of the bill. And whether you want to change it or not is a policy issue that you'd have to address, but I think that's a fair reading of the bill. But you could get there if the tribal government adopted state law as an element of the tribal code. With respect to Mr. Snyder's observation, it's going to be my advice to my client, frankly, that if the bill passes in the form that it is, that the requirement that the tribe have a tribal tort claims law that is similar to the Oregon Tort Claims Act, my advice to my client is going to be that that similarity has to extend to the duty to defend and indemnify. But that language is not explicitly in the bill. And as we talked about during the public hearing, as a practical matter, no tribal government could employ, could get a police officer to come to work for them if they told the police officer, look, you come to work for us, we're not going to defend and indemnify you for liabilities that exceed what the limits are in our Tort Claims Act. That's just not, it's not a way that you can do business as any kind of an employer, public employer. So I don't think it's a real problem for the reasons I explained previously to the committee. It also assumes, in my analysis, the unconstitutionality of the Tort Claims Act itself. If you don't assume that, then you don't have any distinction between the coverage applied to state officers and local officers and tribal officers under the existing language of the bill. So I don't think it's necessary to change it, but for what it's worth, my advice to my client would be that the existing language would require my client to defend and indemnify officers. And then I think I was asked to answer a third question, but I forget what it was.
I thought it was just the two.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Wayne.
So just help me understand why we wouldn't put that into the bill. I mean, I hear what you're saying, that they'd be foolish not to do it, and they may not be able to hire anybody, but what was the reasoning behind it not being explicit in the bill?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Wingard, everybody assumed it was required. That's why it wasn't expressly in the bill. It never occurred to anybody, as looking at the language, that a police agency, any police employer, would not defend and indemnify its employees, else you couldn't operate the department. So it's just an issue that didn't come up. If we were writing this and had the luxury of time to do it, I wouldn't have, my client wouldn't have any objection to including that explicit language in the requirement. And maybe it's still possible to do that. We wouldn't cause us to object. We view it to be implicit anyway in the requirement of the language.
Appreciate you both. Last call. Anyone else wants to weigh in on these amendments to Senate Bill 412? So again, our plan on this is to get the rest of the conflict amendments that relate to Senate Bill 405, the University Police Bill, folded in with these amendments and move it at 8 a.m. on Monday. So with that, see no other comments, colleagues?
Did you want
to? Yeah, so we'll go back. So I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 412 and reopen a work session on Senate Bill 395. If there's no objection, we'll allow Representative Freeman to weigh in on that one as well. Seeing no objection. Patsy, you want to call the single roll?
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Motion still carries. Close the work session on Senate Bill 395, and we'll see you at... 8 a.m.
8
a.m. on Monday. Rules Committee, 8 a.m. on Monday. We're adjourned.